Russian forces continued their intense shelling of the eastern city of Bakhmut.
For Russian forces, taking control over Bakhmut would mean getting closer to their goal of getting control of the Donetsk region.
Plus, Ukrainian and Moldovan officials claim that Russia is trying to destabilize Moldova. How does last week's government shakeup factor in?
This is one of the reasons of change of this government is to meet those challenges.
And later in the program, the challenges of providing aid to abandoned pets in war zones. Today is Monday, February 13th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ukraine said on Monday that Russian forces were hitting the area north of Bakhmut with intense shelling and storming actions. The city of Bakhmut is located in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. It has been the site of months of heavy fighting with Russia pushing to capture the entire area. Joining us with the latest from Kyiv is Anna Chernikova.
For now, what we have from the, you know, confirmed information from Ukrainian military that we can rely on. Yesterday in the evening, it was announced that no journalists and no civilians would be allowed to get into the Bakhmut anymore, because there is a high risk that Russian forces can actually get control of all the entrances. It's not yet the case. At least Ukrainian military, they stay in the city, they keep the control of the city, and they keep the control of the supply routes. So the situation for this point of time remains very tough. And of course, Bakhmut is the main hotspot. And for Russian forces, taking control over Bakhmut would mean getting closer to their goal of getting control of the Donetsk region. However, for Ukrainian forces, the city of Bakhmut is not that strategic. It doesn't mean that it's not important. It is very important. First of all, it, of course, saves time for Ukrainian military to prepare for more defense and better defense of the rest of the Donetsk region. And secondly, it's important in terms of the supply chains, because when and if Russian forces takes control of Bakhmut, they also would take control of one of the main supply road.
And Anna, one last question. On Tuesday, there is going to be a meeting held at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany between U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov. This will be a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, where it's reported they're going to talk about priorities. But this is also coming on news that, according to the Associated Press, Austria is coming under some pressure for allowing Russia to attend next week's Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe meeting that the United States is also part of, as well as reporting from the Kyiv Independent that Austria is refusing to train Ukrainian soldiers on the Leopard 2 tanks. So what have Kyiv officials said are their primary objectives with Tuesday's meeting?
Very important event is to happen tomorrow. And we have a comment actually from the Minister of Defense of Ukraine, Oleksiy Reznikov. So in his social media, he made a little announcement regarding tomorrow's meeting, and he said that the ninth meeting of the Ramstein format would include, so the main points that would be under the discussion, first of all, and the most important is the protection of Ukrainian sky. So air defense with, as he said, with the involvement of aviation. So definitely the question of air jets and aviation support, probably air jet supply, possible air jet supply would be discussed. And of course, Kyiv and Ukrainian position in these terms is definitely very strong, as President Zelensky also during his latest meetings with international allies, he was also discussing air jets as the main priority. Also, the minister confirmed that the discussion would be about the development and includes development of the so-called tank coalition and improvement of this tank coalition. So it might be that exactly the questions of training and the questions of involvement of more countries might be discussed. The discussion regarding the supplies, the needed supplies on those that need that are needed on the battlefield is definitely going to be one of the, you know, also main priorities. What minister confirmed that training programs for Ukrainian soldiers would be discussed, and also the stability of this support and also this not only support of the, you know, of the supplies, but also logistics, also the repair works of the supplies that are provided, which is provided to Ukraine. So quite a wide range of questions, but of course everyone would, and in Ukraine at least, the main concentration and the main, you know, priority and the main interest would be probably in this first 2 points, is air jets and aviation and tank coalition.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, as always, thank you very much for your assistance today, and please stay safe.
Thank you, Steve.
The United States has told its citizens to leave Russia immediately due to the war in Ukraine and the risk of arbitrary arrests or harassment by Russian law enforcement agencies. The United States has repeatedly warned its citizens to leave Russia. The last such public warning was in September, after Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a partial mobilization. Ukraine's Prosecutor General, Andrei Kostin, has called for the creation of an ad hoc international tribunal to investigate and prosecute Russia for the crime of aggression in Ukraine. Oleksiy Kovalenko has those details.
Both international and Ukrainian courts are investigating war crimes committed by Russia after it invaded Ukraine in February of last year. Now Ukrainian authorities are calling on the international community to create a tribunal to investigate and prosecute Russia for the crime of aggression. The Prosecutor General of Ukraine, Andriy Kostin, says it's a necessary step.
Ukraine calls for the establishment of the ad hoc special tribunal for the crime of aggression as most feasible and efficient route for accountability.
Kostin says it's up to the international community to hold Russia accountable, because Ukraine's justice system cannot take legal action against leaders of a different country. And involving the UN is problematic because Russia is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and could veto any attempts to bring forward a case. The US State Department is considering various formats to potentially create an international tribunal, and is also suggesting that at this stage, creating an interim prosecution office would
bring together Ukrainian prosecutors with other interdisciplinary and international experts to start collecting the information that would be used to undergird a prosecution for the crime of aggression.
Clint Williamson, the former US ambassador for war crimes, is on the international team to help Ukraine with the war crimes prosecution. He stresses the importance of having an office at The Hague.
I think as these discussions have progressed, as people have looked at other options, one of them that has been talked about is the creation of an interim prosecutor's office that would pave the way for ultimately establishing a tribunal, that we're making progress on this.
Also this year, President Biden signed the Justice for Victims of War Crimes Act, which makes it possible to prosecute alleged Russian war criminals in the United States.
Under the original statute, we could only prosecute war crimes if either the victim or the perpetrator was a U.S. person. And so that meant that Russian war crimes against Ukrainian civilians, women, children, POWs in custody, none of those could be prosecuted in U.S. courts.
For now, the wheels of justice are moving slowly, especially on the international stage, and officials say it could be years before any alleged war criminal come to trial. Oleksiy Kovalenko for VOA News, Washington.
Reuters cites a Belta news agency report that Belarus will this year host 3 drills of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or CSTO, a Russian-dominated alliance of former Soviet states. It quoted the Secretary General of the organization as saying that the exercises would be codenamed Cooperation, Echelon, and Search. For continuously updated stories about the war throughout the day, be sure to visit our website, voanews.com/Flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. On Friday, February 10th, after the resignation of Prime Minister Natalia Grevelita, Moldova's president tapped her defense and security advisor, Dorian Rechan, as the new prime minister. Moldova's newly tapped prime minister is expected to be approved by the parliament as soon as this week and carry on pro-Western policies. Monday's Moldova's president outlined what she says is Moscow's plan to overthrow Moldova's government and involves the use of external saboteurs that would ultimately, in her words, put her country at the disposal of Russia, as well as throw it off course to one day join the European Union. President Maria Sandu's briefing on Monday comes a week after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country had intercepted plans by Russian secret services to destroy Moldova. On Saturday, I spoke with VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze to get a better understanding of what's happening.
The change in the government looks like a sudden. However, from experts and from politicians, I'm hearing that these changes were preparing these changes for a long time. And they were just looking for the right time to make those changes. Many experts told me that this change of government is just a midterm reshuffling. And they tried to do this last year. There was a lot of discussions in the parliament. And the main issue is that the previous government did a good job in setting up reforms and trying to meet all the challenges. However, the security challenge, the main challenge for Moldova today, need more fresh outlook on the situation.
Now, you say that the security challenges. Now, there have been several reports, even by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, that Russia is trying to actively destabilize Moldova. What have you learned in your conversations with experts and other people in Moldova?
Exactly that. Some politicians told me that there are a lot of Russian agents in the country, that they are trying to destabilize the situation. They are working on pro-Russian political agenda in Moldova. So this is one of the reasons of change of this government is to meet those challenges and try to stabilize and ensure stability in the country.
Miroslava, as you mentioned, security is a primary focus for this new government. But what other things is the new government of Moldova going to focus on?
It looks like the newly appointed government will be carry on the previous government policies. The new appointed prime minister worked as an interior minister in Moldovan government previously. And in the last half a year or a little bit more than half a year was the defense advisor for president of Moldova. So it looks like they were preparing him to take this role for a long time. The president of Moldova and the newly appointed prime minister are saying that they will carry on the reforms. They thank the previous government for their work, and they are looking to make those reforms stronger, specifically judiciary reform, energy reforms, because Moldova depends on Russian energy a lot. So all those policies will be carried on in the next government.
Miroslava Gongadze is VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief. She's joining us via Microsoft Teams from Poland. Miroslava, thank you.
Thank you.
As we've previously discussed in this program, it's not only the people of Ukraine that have been affected by Russia's full-scale invasion nearly a year ago. Cities have been turned to rubble and forced millions of others to relocate. Pets have sometimes made the journey with their human companions. But what about the families who don't leave or the animals that are left behind? The UHearts Foundation is a nonprofit organization helping thousands of abandoned pets in Ukraine and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Yuri Tikorsky is the organization's chief executive officer and in March of 2022 started the Save Pets of Ukraine initiative. I began our conversation by asking him for his assessment of the situation nearly a year into the war.
Yes, Steve. Well, I would start with some numbers just to give an impression of what was the situation like before the war. And prior to the war, over 50% of Ukrainian households were pet owners. So when we are imagining millions of people who are being displaced because of the war, be it within the country or people relocating abroad, we should consider that over a half of them were pet owners, and either they took their pet with them on their way, or more often than not, they were forced to abandon the animals in their homes, hoping to come back for them at a later stage. And very often, unfortunately, that never happened. So, on the one hand, we had a situation where there were hundreds of thousands of people on the move with their animals, and there were hundreds of thousands of animals who were abandoned in areas closer to the front lines, especially, and who were suffering without proper care. So we started in February and in March. Those were probably the months where we got the peak number of requests for help. And we got closer to 130,000 of requests about a number of animals that required food. So we started with this kind of emergency response by providing food to shelters and to pet volunteers, who were then distributing them to the animals in need. And in the year of our operation, we distributed over 1,000 tons of pet food. So roughly speaking, if we divide that by the average amount of food a cat or a dog needs per day, we can say that we helped over 200,000 animals in the whole country.
Yuri, the Save Pets of Ukraine initiative does more than just supply food to either individual pets' families. It also addresses larger issues on a systemic nature, and one of them is supplying medical supplies to those animals in need. And we've heard from various NGOs and other aid organizations that it is a logistical challenge to try and get medicines to those in areas of the conflict. How are you addressing some of that?
It's actually number one problem that the shelters are facing right now is the medical treatment, because many animals, many pets that are being in their care, that are coming into their care, these are domestic animals. They are not meant to be living on the streets. They are not fit to survive on the streets. And very often when they are found, they are already very sick. And there is no clarity about their vaccination status. So the first thing that a shelter would do would be to vaccinate them and to offer them the treatment. So indeed, it is costly. It requires personnel. And very often in the frontline areas, the logistics is difficult. So the way we were helping was to procure vaccinations and to offer them delivered to the specific shelters, and to purchase medications and also have them delivered. And the delivery is done by our volunteers. Very often, we also partner with other organizations who are delivering humanitarian aid, aid for humans. And we ask them also to bring along the pet food. And despite all the difficulties, we have been able to find a lot of brave people who are literally risking their lives. They are driving very often in their own cars to do all these places that are difficult to reach, but they are trying to do that at least every couple of days to make sure that the animals are taken care of on a regular basis, because that's also important, not just to help this one time, but to keep helping regularly.
We only have a few seconds left, but what is really needed, in your opinion, moving forward?
Well, one important aspect that we are going to face very soon is the issue of sterilization. It's spay and neuter operations, basically. And prior to the war, it was a matter to be funded from the local budget. So these are institutions who are run by the local governments. And since the challenges of the war have put both the financial pressure, the staffing pressure, and also it's an issue of priorities. So when local governments are short of resources, they have to prioritize. And very often spay and neuter operations are suffering because of that. And if there is not enough investment, if there is not enough help from organizations like ours to offer spay and neuter to support these centers, then come spring, we will be facing a situation where the numbers of these animals would grow exponentially.
Yuri Tokarski is the chief executive officer of the UHeart Foundation. He's speaking to us via WhatsApp from his office in Vienna, Austria. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's a pleasure to meet you.
And finally, in the southwestern state of Arizona on Sunday, two American football teams squared off against one another in the season's championship match, referred to as the Super Bowl. Quarterback Patrick Mahomes led the Kansas City Chiefs to a 38-35 victory over the Philadelphia Eagles. It was the Chiefs' second NFL title in 4 years, and two-time NFL MVP Mahomes earned his second Super Bowl MVP award. Now, what does this game have to do with our program? Well, while the Chiefs and the Eagles took to the field last night, members of the Ukrainian League American Football took to the field of battle. Olena Adamenko has this story to round us out, narrated by Anna Rice.
This video dedicated to the Super Bowl 2023 was made by members of the Uzhgorod Lumberjacks Ukrainian League American football team that is currently on the front lines defending their country.
Behind us is the Russian-Ukrainian border. In this way, we wanted to thank the American people for their support, for helping us.
Before the war, Fedor Shandar was president of the American Football Federation of Zakarpattia Oblast. These days, however, he is a member of Ukraine Armed Forces and serves on the northeastern border of Ukraine.
Ex-governor of New York came here. He's of Hungarian descent, I think, and gave us a few dozen footballs as a gift. He came, of course, to bring some humanitarian aid to Ukraine, but since he's an American football fan, he brought us gifts as well.
Shandar has been playing American football for some 15 years. He says he chose this sport because of his size.
I'm somewhat heavyset, but that's the beauty of American football. Anyone can play, really. No matter if you're slim or on the heavier side, tall or short, anyone plays. It's a rare sport where this is the case.
The team Shandor plays for, Uzhgorod Lumberjacks, are three-time champions of Ukraine's American Football League. However, right now, over half of the team are on the front lines.
American football teams usually consist of some 50-60 people. We have 24. 15 team members are on the front lines, and we have lost one of our team members, sadly. Danilo Bohuslavski died.
Danilo Bohuslavski died in October 2022 while fighting in the Kherson region. He was 32. His brother Roman Bohuslavski, also a soldier and an American football player, received an invitation to Super Bowl 2023. All the Uzhgorod Lumberjacks team members plan to watch the Super Bowl final. Some, like team member Vitaly Milnik, will do it from the front lines in the Kharkiv region.
We're all looking forward to the game on Sunday. It's sacred for me. I think this Sunday in February will always be something I look forward to, and nothing, not even the war, will stop me.
For Alena Adamenko in Sumy region, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well,
be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.